Marquis had pointed out during this discussion at their nightly meal that a formation of starships multiplied the available firepower to generate an excellent shield and provided a much greater all-round coverage than a singleton. "Remember Santa Chico, Captain," Roderick had replied. "We should examine history and move on from our failings in an appropriate fashion. Tempora mutantur. Tactics evolve in association with technology." Marquis hadn't been on the Santa Chico campaign, thank God. But that planet was always a one-shot. Thal Spring wouldn't have anything like their level of technology. If by some miracle they had built exo-orbital systems, they'd be the old-fashioned kind. "Course to 600-kilometer orbit plotted, sir," Colin Jeffries said. Marquis reviewed the fusion drive schematics that his D&I was scrolling. Overall failsoft was 96%, which was good. They'd spent 3 months before the mission in dock at Centralis having a C-list refit. Only if failsport dropped below 70% would he cancel ignition. "Cleared for ignition, Mr. Jeffries. Alert the life support wheels to secure for gravity shift." "Yes, sir." "Anyone know what's happening on the planet?" Roderick inquired lightly. Adul Kwan looked up from the bridge station he'd appropriated. He'd routed a lot of sensor readings to his holographic panes, where analysis routines were reinterpreting the raw data. "Standard microwave and radio emissions. I'm also seeing hot spots corresponding to known settlement sites. They're still there and effective." "Ah, some good news." "Very well. They'll attempt to contact us soon enough. There's to be no response. I'll talk to the president once we're in orbit." "Understood." Amber lights began to flash, warning them of the fusion drive ignition. "Sir, the Norvell has come out of Exodus," Colin Jeffries reported. "Excellent," Roderick said. "I'm going to my cabin. I doubt you need me breathing down your neck right at this moment, eh, Captain? You have my every confidence to deliver us into orbit unharmed." Marquis didn't look round. "I'll inform you of any status change." One thing Denise, Ray, and Joseph had never properly taken into account was how little lead time they'd have. Their prime software might have trawled the SpaceCom alert from the data pool with a minimum delay, but that didn't mean there weren't others who were just as fast. Leaks were also a factor. The verified sighting was automatically distributed to over 100 government personnel. Most of them had family. All of them had friends and media contacts. 15 minutes after SpaceCom's internal verification of Starship Exodus, the general media knew of the alert and started bombarding the president's office for official confirmation and a public statement. It was just after midnight in Durrell, the capital, but the president's Praetorian aides responded swiftly. Their first cautious release that anomalous SpaceCom data was being reviewed hardly satisfied the howling mob, but it did give them enough justification to start breaking the story across the data pool and on the news shows. It was a story that fed on its own hysteria, expanding with each retelling. Recordings of the last invasion were snatched from their libraries and broadcast in extreme detail, reminding everyone of the oppression and brutality they'd suffered, as if they needed such cues. 30 minutes later, just about all of Thal Spring knew the starships had come again. In their single act of public responsibility that day, the media announcers did keep repeating there was no need to panic. The starships were 8 million kilometers away. Given how many people were desperate to hear the entire message, it amazed psychologists just how many managed to blank that part out. Human nature being what it is, people's overriding instinct in times of danger is simply to head for home. It's a baseline refuge, seeking comfort and security from contact with your own family. In every city, people walked out of work to hail the nearest taxi or jump on their tram. Bikes and cars poured onto the roads. There hadn't been traffic snarl-ups and gridlock like it for over a decade. In fact, not since the last time the starships arrived. Denise's usual 20-minute trip back to the bungalow on the Niam River estuary took nearly an hour and a half. She hadn't realized so many people even lived in Memu Bay, let alone had cars or bicycles or scooters. So much time had been wasted just sitting in trams expecting them to move any minute. Nobody ever drove down the tram lines in the center of the road until today, when they blocked it solid. Eventually, she hopped out of the stationary vehicle and started walking. Fortunately, the local data pool retained its integrity through the chaos, though even its connection time had slowed appreciably as half the town used it to contact the other half and ask them where they were. She sent a stack of pre-formatted messages through her own ring pearl, using Prime to route the heavily encrypted packages to various resistance cell members so they would be untraceable. Acknowledgements returned sporadically, scrolling across her vision as she dodged traffic and slithered around lumbering pedestrians. Outside the town's heart, the traffic wasn't so clogged, which allowed the vehicles to drive a hell of a lot faster. They'd all had their AS programs taken offline, with the human driver ignoring the speed limits. Denise jogged along the suburb pavements, sprinting across intersections. Not even being young and female saved her from vigorous hand signals as cars swerved. When she did trot up the gravel path to their front door, she was sweating enough to make her blouse and skirt cling annoyingly. Ray and Joseph still weren't home. They'd been out on a boat when Spacecom's alert was given. Their last message said they were less than 10 minutes behind her now. She wondered how they'd manage that with the melee constricting the center of town. The bags they'd need were permanently packed. Denise disengaged the bungalow's active alarm and tugged them from the hall cupboard where they were stowed. A couple of sports shoulder bags, the kind anybody would take for a week's holiday. Inside were clothes, some needing washing, toiletries, coral souvenirs, several bracelet pearls with the supplements any student would own. All the items would pass a spot inspection. It would take a detailed lab analysis to detect any sort of subterfuge. Her ring pearl interrogated the hidden systems, running final function and power checks. Once their validity was confirmed, she dumped them beside the door, then ran back to her own room, stripping off her blouse. Her blood still seemed to be hot and fizzing, even though her heart had slowed right down. Now the starships had arrived, she felt invigorated. A simple, faded copper T-shirt and black shorts gave her a great deal more freedom of movement. She twisted the plain gold braid on her index finger that contained the pearl, reassured by the contact. A strange preparation ritual for a warrior about to go into combat, but then this was not an arena the gladiators, knights, and ninjas of old would recognize. Denise was lacing up her sneakers on the doorstep when the boys arrived. They'd acquired an open-top jeep from the diving school, which Joseph was driving. He braked it to a sharp halt at the end of the drive. Ray jumped out and slung the cases in the rear. Denise took the back seat. She was still slipping on her safety harness when Joseph accelerated away, sending gravel pelting into the jasmine. "Which way are you going?" she asked. "We figured the outer loop road," Ray called over his shoulder. "It's longer, but the traffic regulation AS says it's still relatively clear." Denise visualized a layout of the town. Their bungalow was just about on the opposite side from the airport. Perhaps they should have planned that better as well. But once they got onto the loop road, it would take them directly there. "How long?" she asked Joseph. She had to shout. The wind was whipping her short hair about as he sped them along the concrete road with its broad, neatly mown verges. 45 minutes, he said. "You're kidding." His smile was grim. "I can do it." "Okay." Denise started to instruct her prime, and indigo timetables slid across her vision. Scheduled planes were still flying out of the airport. According to the bookings program, just about every tourist in Memu Bay was trying to bring his or her departure flight forward to today. Prime accessed the Pan Skyways reservation system and searched through the passenger list on a flight to Durrell that was due to leave in 1 hour and 10 minutes. Only a quarter of them had checked in so far. Several had contacted the airline to say they'd been caught up in the traffic snarl and were running late. Sensible people, she thought. She erased two of them and substituted Ray and Joseph under their ghost identities. "We're in," she said gleefully. The loop road was a big improvement. At first, traffic on their side of town was light. It began to build, increasing in proportion to the distance to the airport. Even Joseph had to slow down as both lanes began to fill. "Where have they all come from?" she asked, looking round in dismay. Family cars, sedans with darkened windshields, jeeps like theirs, vans and trucks. Everyone had a driver gripping the wheel with an intent, "don't mess with me" expression on his face. "I don't know," Joseph muttered, "but I know where they're going." He swung the wheel sharply, sending the jeep around a big pickup and onto the hard shoulder. Free of the jammed-up main lanes, he accelerated again. Tires bounced frantically through the potholes, the suspension juddering loudly. Ray grinned happily. "There goes your license." "It's a stolen jeep, and I'm not licensed to drive it anyway. Now smile for the traffic cameras." Denise rolled her eyes and pulled a floppy old fishing hat on her head as other drivers shouted at them. To the side of them, traffic was grinding to a complete halt. She could see the kind of luggage people were carrying. Cars just had suitcases thrown into the back seats, but several vans and pickups were piled high with furniture. Some even had pets, mainly dogs barking in confusion. A small pony peered nervously out of one rig. She couldn't understand where they thought they were going. It wasn't as if this continent had a big rural community that could absorb them. There was only the Great Loop Highway with its scattered settlements around the Mitchell Plateau Mountains, and she knew what their inhabitants would think of refugees from the city. "Damn," Joseph grunted. Other people had started to swerve onto the hard shoulder. Vehicles stuck on the inside lane were tooting their horns furiously at the lawbreakers trundling past. It didn't take more than another 500 meters before the hard shoulder was reduced to a parking lot. They were still a good 12 kilometers from the airport. "Go around them," Ray said. Sighing, Joseph engaged the high-traction mode for the hub motors and urged the jeep off the hard shoulder and onto the verge. They bounced along the grass, tilted at quite an angle. Tires left long spin tracks in soil still wet from the morning's downpour. Cars on the hard shoulder tooted angrily as they bumped and fishtailed past the completely stationary lines. That ride ended 3 kilometers short of the airport when the verge turned into a cutting. The banks were too steep for the jeep to use, even on high traction. Joseph braked, and they slowly slithered down the slope until the tire rims were resting on the curbstones lining the hard shoulder. Nothing was moving on the dual roadway. People had climbed out of their vehicles, talking to each other in exasperated voices. Denise could hardly believe it, but the trams on the high-speed link between the roadways were also stationary. Maniac drivers had actually tried to use the rails as a road, ramming through the crash barrier that guarded the outer lane. There was a long zigzag line of cars and vans bumper to bumper along the tramway, looking as if several dozen of them had all collided in slow motion. Those drivers were screaming at each other. She could see several fistfights had broken out. "Out," Joseph said. "Come on, we're close enough now." A big DB-898 passenger plane thundered overhead, its undercarriage bogies folding into its fuselage. High hydrogen turbofans whined loudly as it rose in a steep climb. Everyone standing about on the road stopped what they were doing to watch it pass. The majority then started walking, as if the aircraft had been some kind of religious summons. Denise, Joseph, and Ray started a fast, easy jog, drawing jealous stares from families and older people tramping along the concrete with moody desperation. Thanks to the de-written enhancements throughout their bodies, the weight of the bags and the intense mid-afternoon sun had no effect on them, so they were able to maintain a steady pace for the entire 3 kilometers. Denise had a mild sweat when they reached the arrivals hall, but that was all. The crowds around the various airline gateways were thicker than fans going into a stadium turnstile on a league finals day, and a lot more restless. They pushed and shoved their way toward the front, either ignoring or giving out aggressive nose-to-nose stares to anyone who objected. Up on the walls, giant sheet screens were showing man-in-the-street interviews, with just about everyone the reporters found asking the same thing. When are our exo-orbit defenses going to blast these invader bastards into radioactive gas? Surely some clandestine top-secret government project had built them ready for this moment. Why are we defenseless? They arrived at the Pan Skyways gate, 3 to 5 minutes left until boarding ended. There, in the middle of 500 noisy, straining, angry people, Denise gave them both a kiss and a hug. If they were surprised by the uncharacteristic display of affection, they didn't show it. She'd often been exasperated by them during the last year. Now she realized how much she cared for them, almost as much as for their mission. "Look after yourselves," she mumbled. It wasn't a wish, it was a command. They returned the hug, promising her they would. When they showed their ghost identity cards to the gate, it opened smoothly to let them through. Denise wormed her way out through the crush of people and went up to the observation deck on the roof. She was the only person there. A humid offshore breeze plucked at her T-shirt as she stood pressed up against the railing. 20 minutes later, the big Pan Skyways jet taxied out onto the runway and raced into the hot sky. Denise watched it vanish into the hazy horizon, then lifted her gaze to the sky's zenith. 7 tiny, bright stars were visible through the azure veil. Her arms were spread wide, hands gripping the smooth, worn metal of the railing. When she took a deep breath, she could feel the oxygen flowing through her arteries, fortifying her enhanced cells. Her physical strength brought a cool self-confidence with it, a state of mind she relished. "Welcome back," she told the sparkling interlopers. "Things are going to be a little different this time around." Simon Roderick sat at the desk in his appropriated cabin, surrounded by data. Some of it came from holographic panes, the rest was provided by DNI. All of it flowed and flashed at his whim. Organization, the key to success in any field, even one with as many intangibles as this. He knew how Captain Crojan considered himself at the mercy of the Korobu's AS, how isolated that made him from the physical running of the starship. A situation Simon never placed himself in, no matter what his supervisory assignment. The captain's trouble was his insistence on routing commands through his officers, keeping them involved. If he kept humans out of the equation, he would find himself a lot closer to achieving true authority over his machinery. The stream of information enveloping Simon shifted as the last of the Third Fleet starships reached its 600-kilometer orbit. Its new pattern was close to the optimum he had envisaged. Needless to say, Thallspring had deployed no exo-orbit weapons against the starships during their approach. They had, though, endured a constant bombardment of communication traffic during the flight into orbit. Several tape virals had been hidden in the packages, some of them quite sophisticated for an isolated world. The Korobu's AS had recognized and isolated them immediately. None of them had come even close to the barbarian sentience subversives that the anti-globalizers had used back on Earth. Simon shifted his attention to the images building up from the small squadron of observation satellites that the Third Fleet had released into low Thallspring orbit. It was a world that had moved ahead in a steady pedestrian fashion since ZB's last asset realization. Infrared mapping showed the settlements had expanded roughly as predicted, although Durrell was certainly larger than expected. Worst case, it gave them 100,000 more people, which the ground forces could certainly handle. Fortunately, that corresponded to an increase in industrial output. After all, those extra people had to be housed, clothed, fed, and provided with jobs. Several blank zones on the planetary simulation caused him a flicker of dissatisfaction. His personal AS noted the direction of his ire and informed him that 3 observation satellites and 1 geostationary communications relay had failed. The successfully deployed systems were being reprogrammed to fill the gaps. He sent the planetary data into peripheral mode and established a link to Captain Crojan. The officer's sullen face appeared on a hologram pane. "I'd like you to begin the gamma soak, please," Simon said. "I wasn't aware our reviews were complete," Crojan said. "There could be people down there." "The primary scans haven't found any artificial structures in the location we selected. That's good enough for me. Begin the soak." He canceled the link before there was an argument and expanded the Korobu's schematics out of the grid. Just behind the starship's compression drive section, their gamma projector began to unfurl. The mechanism had been included on all of ZB's colonist carrier starships as fundamental to establishing a settlement. Basically a vast gamma-ray generator and focusing array, it was a cylinder 15 meters in diameter and 20 long, riding on the end of a telescopic robot arm. Once it was clear of the drive section, the cylinder's outer segments peeled open like a mechanical flower. On the inside, the petals were studded with hundreds of black and silver hexagonal irradiator nozzles. A second set of segments hinged open around the first, followed by a third. At full extension, it formed a circular disc 60 meters across. Thal Spring's second-largest ocean was rolling past underneath the Korobu, with the coastline sliding into view over the horizon. Durrell was directly ahead of the starship, a gray smear amid the emerald crescent of land that was the settlement's enclave of terrestrial vegetation. Outside that, Thal Spring's native aquamarine plants embraced the rest of the land. Korobu's gamma projection array swung around on the end of its arm until it was pointing toward the settlement. Small azimuth actuators tweaked its alignment and began tracking. Tokamaks inside the starship's compressor drive section started to power up, feeding their colossal energy output straight into the projector array. The amount of energy demanded by a starship to fly faster than light sliced down through the atmosphere in a beam that was no more than 100 meters wide when it struck the surface. The impact was centered on a patch of ground at the western perimeter of the settlement, just overlapping the border of the earth plants. No living cell of any type could survive such a concentration of radiation. Thal Spring's plants, animals, insects, and bacteria died instantly beneath the beam, a huge zone of vegetation that immediately turned bruise brown and began to wither. Branches and leaves bowed down and curled up beneath the relentless, invisible onslaught. Fissures split open along tree trunks, hissing out steam from ruptured osmotic capillaries. Animals thudded to the ground, skins shriveled to black parchment and innards cooked, spitting out little wisps of smoke as they ossified in seconds. Even below ground, nothing was spared. The gamma rays penetrated deep into the soil, eradicating bacteria and burrowing insects. Then the beam began to move, scanning back and forth across the ground in slow, kilometer-wide swaths. Simon shifted the soak data into peripheral. He used the Third Fleet geostationary relays to open a connection into Thal Spring's data pool and requested a link to the president. The man whose image appeared on his holographic pane was in his late 50s, heavy features roughened by lack of sleep, but there was enough anger burning in his eyes to compensate for any insomnia lethargy. "Stop your bombardment," President Edgar Strauss growled. "For fuck's sake, we're not any kind of military threat." Simon's eyebrow twitched at the obscenity. If only Earth's politicians were as forthright. "Good day, Mr. President. I thought it best if I introduced myself first. I'm Simon Roderick, representing the Xantiu Braun Board." "Switch your goddamn death ray off." "I'm not aware of any bombardment, Mr. President. Your starship is firing on us." Simon tented his fingers, giving the pane and its reply camera a thoughtful look. "No, Mr. President. Xantiu Braun is continuing to upgrade its investment. We are preparing a fresh section of land for the Durrell settlement to expand into. Surely that's beneficial to you." "Take your investment and stuff it where the sun doesn't shine, you little tit." "Is there an election coming up, Mr. President? Is that why you're talking tough?" "What would the likes of you know about democracy?" "Please, Mr. President, it's best not to annoy me. I do have to monitor our beam guidance program very closely. Neither of us would want it to move out of alignment at this crucial moment now, would we?" The president glanced at someone out of camera range, listening for a moment as his expression soured further. "All right, Roderick, what do you bastards want this time?" We're here to collect our dividend, Mr. President, as I'm sure you know. Why the hell can't you just say it? Too frightened of what we'll do? You're pirates who will slaughter all of us if we don't comply. Nobody is going to slaughter people, Mr. President. As well as being a crime against humanity with a mandatory death penalty in the World Justice Court, it would be stupidly counterproductive. Xanthio Braun has a great deal of money tied up in Thal Spring. We don't want to jeopardize that. Edgar Strauss became even more angry. We're an independent world, not some part of your corporate empire. Our funding was raised by the Navarro House, who sold their interest in Thal Spring to us. Some goddamn tax avoidance bullshit on a planet 23 light-years away that doesn't entitle you to come here and terrorize us. We're not terrorizing you. We're simply here to collect what rightfully belongs to us. Your middle-class daydream existence was bought with our money. You cannot run away from your fiscal responsibilities. We need a return on that money. And if we choose not to? You do not have that choice, Mr. President. As the lawfully elected head of state, it is your obligation to provide us with assets that we can liquidate back on Earth. If you personally fail to meet that requirement, you will be removed and replaced by a successor who isn't so foolish. What if all of us refuse? Think you can intimidate all 18 million of us into handing over our possessions to you thugs? That isn't going to happen, and you know it. No, because you'll fucking kill us if we try. Mr. President, as the officially designated retriever of your planetary dividend, I am serving you formal notice that it is due. You will now tell me if you will comply with its collection. Well now, Mr. Board Representative, as president of the independent planet of Thal Spring, I am telling you that we do not recognize the jurisdiction of Earth or any of its courts out here. However, I will surrender to a military invasion fleet that threatens our well-being and allow your soldiers to loot our cities. Good enough, Simon smiled brightly. I will post lists of the assets we require. My subordinates will transfer down to the planet's surface to supervise their shipment. We'll also help reinforce your police force in case of any civil disturbance. I'm sure both of us want this to go as smoothly as possible. The quicker it's done, the quicker we leave. He canceled his link to Edgar Strauss and issued the general landing order. We have a go authorization, Captain Bryant informed Lawrence. Get your platoon suited up. We'll embark the drop gliders in 2 hours' time. Yes, sir. Have we got the updated ground cartography yet? Tactical support is processing the surveillance satellite data at this moment. Don't worry, Sergeant. You'll have it before you fly down. Now carry on. Sir. He turned to face the platoon. They were all hanging on the edges of their bunks, facing him expectantly. Okay, we're on. Hal let out a loud whoop of satisfaction and jacked out of his bunk. The rest followed, keen for an end to the voyage, even one that pitched them into a hostile environment. Lawrence was first into their suit armory. One of the reasons Korobu's life support wheels were so cramped was the amount of space the skin suits took up in transit. Each one was stored in a bulky glass-fronted sustainer cabinet, which fed it a regulated supply of nutrients and oxygen. He walked down to the cabinet with his own suit inside and opened the small drawer on the bottom. It was empty, apart from a plastic capsule containing a pair of full-spectrum optronic membranes. He slipped them onto his eyes and began to undress. There was plenty of joshing and derisory comments as the platoon put in their own membranes and stripped off their one-piece tunics. Lawrence didn't join in. The banter had an edge to it as the reality of Thal Spring crept toward them, their way of riding over the jitters. He stripped naked except for a slim necklace with a cheap hologram crystal pendant. His thumb stroked the scuffed surface, and a 17-year-old Rosalind smiled brightly at him. Technically, even the necklace was against regulations, but Lawrence hadn't taken it off in 20 years. He pumped the small dispenser button next to the sustainer cabinet's drawer. The metal nozzle squirted out globs of pale blue dermalese gel, which he began to smear over his body. It took a good 5 minutes to cover himself completely, slicking down his short-cropped hair, rubbing it into his armpits and crotch. He and Amorcy did each other's backs and shoulders. Only then was he ready to put his suit on. His cabinet door opened with a quiet wheeze of cool air. He put his palm on the scan panel inside for a bone and blood review. The suit AS compared them to the patterns contained within its E-alpha section and agreed he was Lawrence Newton, the designated wearer. He waited for the disengage sequence to run, cycling the sustainer fluids out of the suit before disconnecting the umbilicals. Indigo script from the suit's AS scrolled down his optronic membranes, showing him its status. Bracing himself on the floor, he lifted the flaccid suit out. In the Korobu's low gravity, it didn't weigh much, but it had roughly the same inertia as his own body. From the outside, it looked no different from any of the other skin suits his platoon was struggling to remove from their cabinets. The flexible carapace was a dark gray color, without any visible seams or ridges. Its fingers were hardened, slightly pointed tips, while the feet were boots with toughened soles. To touch, it had a texture similar to human skin, although the outer layer was the one part that wasn't biological. A smart polycarbon with an external sheet of chameleon molecules and woven with thermal fibers capable of redirecting its infrared signature. Even if a hostile did manage to locate it, the carapace was tough enough to protect him from all handheld projectile weapons and a fair percentage of small artillery pieces. Lawrence gave it the order to egress him, and it split open smoothly across the chest from crotch to neck. Inside the carapace was a stratum of synthetic muscle up to 5 centimeters thick. He pushed his foot into the right leg, feeling the gel ooze against his skin as the limb slithered deeper into the suit. Like squeezing into whale blubber, he always thought. The left leg followed, then the arms were inserted into their sleeves. He tilted his head back and reached round for the helmet, which was hanging loosely. Moving his arms through even a small arc was hard, as if he were trying to shove a gym bar that was on maximum resistance. Slowly, though, the helmet section came up, and he pushed his head up inside. The grill was open and inactive, allowing him to suck down some air. As always, he felt a quick chill of claustrophobia. It was difficult to move. He could see nothing and hear nothing through the helmet. Indigo script blinked up as the AS reported it was ready for full integration. Lawrence gave it permission. The carapace sealed up. A ripple moved along the suit as the synthetic muscle adjusted itself to grip him correctly. The optronic membranes flashed elaborate visual test patterns at him, then began feeding him the picture from sensors mounted around the helmet. He swiveled his eyeballs from side to side, a motion picked up by the suit, which altered the sensor angle accordingly. Audio plugs wriggled into his ears, and he heard the grumbles and complaints of the platoon as they clambered into their own suits. Phase two, he told the suit AES. With his legs held tight by the synthetic muscle, small nozzles extended into the valves on the top of his thighs, which had been surgically spliced into his femoral arteries and veins. A second set of nozzles, coupled with the subclavian valves on his wrists. The last set were on his neck, plugging his carotid artery and jugular vein into the suit's own circulatory system. With the connections physically secure, the suit AS interfaced with the integral E-alpha guards governing the valves, enabling them. They opened, and his blood began to circulate round the suit muscle, blending with the artificial blood that the suit had been hibernating on in its support cabinet. A checklist scrolled down, confirming the suit muscle's integrity. Internal blood bladders held a large reserve of the oxygenated, nutrient-rich fluid capable of being fed into the circulation system when any bursts of strength were required. Other than that, his own organs would have to support the suit muscle entirely by themselves. Phase three. The suit AS began to bring a multitude of peripheral electronic systems online. He'd enhanced the original program with his Prime, which he felt gave him a better response and interface. Nobody else knew about the addition. He still wasn't sure about Prime's legal status, and the ZB Armory technicians disapproved of such customizations. Phase 3 started by providing him with several sensor options, all of which he could link to targeting grids. Communication links ran through their interfaces and encryption codes. Air filters slipped across the helmet grille, giving him immunity from chemical and bioviral attack. Integrated weapons systems ran through test sequences. He selected neutral carapace coloring, shifting it from the original dark gray to a bluer shading that the human eye had difficulty distinguishing. That was coupled with full thermal radiance, allowing him to jettison the heat generated by his body and the skin suit muscle through the thermal fiber weave. His penis sheath confirmed it was secure and capable of allowing him to take a leak any time he needed. Lawrence stood up and examined the range of articulation his new skin gave him, moving his limbs in every direction, bending his body, flexing fingers. Sensors on the inside of the synthetic muscle picked up the initial movement and, in conjunction with the AS, shifted the suit in a corresponding motion. As he worked methodically through the various positions and actions, the yammer of claustrophobia vanished as it always did. Warming up from his subconscious to replace it was a mildly narcotic sense of invulnerability. Even on Santa Chico, his skin had never let him down. Anything that made him less reliant on Captain Bryant was a good thing indeed. Lawrence looked around the compartment. Most of the platoon were already in their skin and running preparation checks. He saw Hal, who only had his helmet left to fit. The kid was sitting on the bench, frozen with worry. Lawrence went over and stood directly in front of him. He flashed the kid a quick thumbs up, unseen by the rest of the platoon. "You need a hand?" His amplified voice bounced round the aluminum walls. "No, Sarge," Hal said gratefully. "I can cope, thanks." His suited hands scrabbled round slowly and awkwardly behind his head, finding the helmet. Then he was pushing himself into the dark covering. The platoon trooped out of the suit armory and lumbered down the corridor to the munitions store. Each skin's AS linked directly with the quartermaster AS to issue the weapons authorization. When he received his allocation, Lawrence's skin split along the top of his arms, revealing various mechanical components that were melded with muscle bands to form hybrid guns and micro silos. He slotted his magazines into their receiver casings and watched as the thin muscle bands undulated, moving missiles and darts into their sacks and chambers. The punch pistol he'd been given was clipped to his belt, ironically the largest weapon and the least lethal. For some unfathomable bureaucratic reason, the Cairns Base AS had decided that the munitions store should also distribute skin blood packs. Lawrence collected his four and secreted them in the abdominal pouches. They'd give him another few hours' endurance should they hit physically demanding conditions. Nice to have. Although, frankly, if the Memu Bay ground forces hadn't established their headquarters and barracks at the end of the first day, it wouldn't matter anyway. Now that the squad was active, they took a lift up to the life support wheel's axis, then transferred down the wide axial corridor to the cargo section. The radial corridor that led out to their drop glider was even narrower, making life difficult for the bulky skin suits. Not that the interior of their little landing craft, a short cylinder filled with two rows of crude plastic chairs, was much of an improvement. They strapped themselves in amid curses about lack of space and bumped elbows. Lawrence took the single chair at the front. It put his head level with a narrow windshield. A small console with two holographic panes was provided in case anything glitched the AS pilot and he needed manual control. For a vehicle intended to deorbit and deliver them to a specific ground coordinate with only a 50-meter margin of error, the whole arrangement seemed totally inadequate. Amorcy closed the hatch and strapped himself in. Short trembles running through the fuselage indicated the other drop gliders were leaving their silos. 8 minutes to go. "Hey, Sarge," Jones called out in their general channel. "I think Carl's testing out his vomit tube. Aren't you, Carl?" "Fuck the hell off." "Knock it off back there," Lawrence said. His optronic membranes alerted him to a call from Captain Bryant, which he admitted. Tactical have completed the cartography of Memu Bay, Bryant said. It's accessible now. Get your platoon to install it. Yes, sir. Any major changes? Not at all. Don't worry, Sergeant. We're on top of this one. I'll see you down there. Meteorology says it's a beautiful day. We might even have a barbecue on the beach this evening. Look forward to it, sir. He canceled the link. Asshole. The suit's AS gave him the platoon's general channel. Okay, we've got the current map. Get it installed and integrated with your inertial navigation. I don't want anyone getting lost. Has it got any decent bars marked on it? Nick asked. Hey, Sarge, can we have access to the derailed guys? Lewis asked. Like to know what's going on. Sure. Odell, set it up. Absolutely, Sergeant. 5 minutes until their flight. Lawrence began installing the new cartography into his skin's neurotronic pearls. Out of curiosity, he accessed the traffic Odell was pulling out of the Durell Force's data pool. His membranes displayed a small 5x5 grid with thumbnail videos from different drop gliders. He expanded one, seeing a shaky picture from the nose camera. A splinter of dark land rocked from side to side in an ultramarine void. Terse voices barked short comments and orders. No ground fire, Amorcy observed. That's good. Have you ever seen any? Hal asked. Not yet, but there's always a first time. 3 minutes. Lawrence dismissed the video grid and requested the new maps of Memu Bay. It looked very similar to the settlement he remembered from the last time he was here. Big features like the stadium and harbor were still there, smaller somehow. He superimposed the old map and let out a shallow breath of aggravation as he took in the new sprawl of outlying districts. Memu Bay had grown beyond ZB's projections. A larger population would be harder to keep in line. Oh, great. No battle plan ever survived engagement with the enemy, but it would be nice to have one that was vaguely relevant when they hit the beach. He opened a link to Captain Bryant. Sir, the settlement's a lot bigger than we thought. Not really, Sergeant. A few percent at most. And physically, there's been no change to the center since last time. Our deployment strategy remains effective. Are we getting any additional platoons? From where? It's Durell that's really grown over the last decade. If anything, we should be supporting our forces there. Are we? He asked in alarm. He never dreamed that the platoon might be switched. That would screw up everything. No, Sergeant, Bryant said wearily. Please monitor your status display, and stop worrying. A bigger population just means more behavior collateral. We're carrying enough units down with us for that. Sir. 1 minute. The intermittent vibrations he could feel through the fuselage suddenly grew more pronounced. When he did check his status display, he saw the captain's drop glider had left the silo beneath them. Icons flashed an alert. Then platoon 435 NK-9's drop glider was shaking as it slid down the silo's rails. "Hang on to your hats, ladies," Edmund sang out. "We're going bungee jumping with angels, and someone just cut the cord." Light burst in through the windshield. Lawrence saw the edge of the silo falling away from them, a dark hexagon framed in lusterless silver-white metal that shrank into the middle of a honeycomb of identical silos. Their retreat brought the rest of the starship into view. Once again, he could only smile at its functional beauty. Drop gliders and pods were being spat out of the silos at a furious rate. They retreated from the Korobu in an expanding cloud, dropping ass first toward the planet below. Pods were just squat, rounded cones with a collar of small rocket motors secured around their peaks. Drop gliders were also cones, but flattened into a standard lifting body shape and fitted with swept-back fins. They'd been coated in a thick, pale gray foam of thermal ablative to get them through atmospheric entry. A rocket motor pack had been attached to their rear. Those he could see falling beside them were puffing out streamers of grubby yellow gas from the reaction control nozzles, turning as they fell. The AS began to fire their own reaction control thrusters, orientating them so the rocket pack was aligned along their orbital track. Thal Springs slipped into view through the windshield, a dusky ocean smeared with hoary clouds, its outer atmosphere a phantom silver corona caressing the water. Memu Bay was hiding over the horizon, a third of the planet away. Orange sparks bloomed around the drop glider as the squadron began to retroburn. Hundreds of solid rocket motor plumes flaring wide in the vacuum, blowing out a cascade of glimmering particles as though some iridescent fluid was part of their chemical formula. Flight profile displays began a countdown for their own drop glider. The solid rocket at the center of the pack ignited, giving them a 4G kick. It was little more than a mild discomfort for the platoon encased in their protective skin. 30 seconds later, it ended as abruptly as it began. Small thrusters fired again, turning them through 180 degrees. Now the nose was pointing along the line of flight. With their speed below orbital velocity, they began the long curve down into the atmosphere. The rocket pack stayed attached for another 15 minutes, maintaining their attitude with steady nudges from the reaction control thrusters. Up ahead of them, a multitude of sparks began to burn once more as the pods and gliders hit the uppermost fringes of gas. They were longer this time, a darker cherry red, and they continued to elongate as the ablative foam vaporized under the vigorous impact of gaseous friction. Soon, space around them was drenched with infernal contrails, arching down toward the planet like the chariots of vengeful gods. Lawrence felt the fuselage start to tremble as they sank deeper into the chemosphere. His communication links to the starship and relay satellites diminished, then dropped out altogether as ionization built up around the fuselage. The AS began to move the fin flaps, testing the vehicle's maneuverability. Once the air surfaces were providing a predetermined level of control, it fired the explosive bolts securing the rocket pack. The jolt flung Lawrence and the others forward into their straps, a motion cushioned by their skin. There was nothing for him to see now. Crimson flames from the slowly disintegrating ablative were playing across the windshield, lighting up the cabin. They were flying blind at Mach 18 inside the crown of a 3-kilometer-long fireball. Gravity began to take hold, pulling them eagerly toward the ground. All he could do was wait and sweat and pray as the AS flicked the lean air surfaces with a dolphin's precision, maintaining stability within the hypersonic glide path. This was the moment he hated and feared above all else. It forced him to invest trust in the cheapest craft ZB could build to accomplish the job, with nothing he could do other than ride it out. He reviewed the platoon, calling up a grid of video and telemetry windows. As expected, Amorcy's heart rate was over 100 while he quietly murmured his way through a gospel chant. Hal was asking a host of questions, which Edmund and Dennis took in turns to answer, argue about, or just tell him to shut up. Carl and Nick were talking quietly together. Jones had brought up maintenance profiles for the jeeps that the lander pods were bringing down for them. Whereas Odell, Lawrence enlarged the man's grid, scanning his suit function telemetry. Odell's head was rocking from side to side, while his hands palm-drummed rhythmically on his knees. He'd accessed a personal file block in his skin's memory. As they were streaking through a planetary atmosphere with the savage brilliance of a dying comet, Odell was happily bopping away to a Slippy Martin track. At Mach 8, the external flames began to die away. Clean blue daylight embraced the drop glider. Lawrence could see the residue of ablative covering their blunt nose, black bubbling tar that sprinkled droplets from the peak of seething ripples. The craft's antenna found the relay satellite's beacon and established a link. Mission tactical data scrolled across his membranes. The other drop gliders, bringing down the Memu Bay force, had made it through aerobreak. One of them, Oakley's platoon, was going to undershoot, coming down 50 kilometers from shore. Their AS was already modifying the descent profile, so they'd land at one of the larger archipelago islands. A helicopter could recover them later. Captain Bryant had already begun shifting deployment patterns to cover the loss. Platoon 435 NK9 was given an extra two streets to sweep. "Always a pleasure," Amorcy grunted as the fresh data installed into their mission orders. "We'll assess on the ground," Lawrence told him. They both knew the extra streets would be left alone. Privilege of having field autonomy. It gave him some leeway. Lawrence's priority was getting the platoon through the town without incident. According to the tactical data, the landing pods were descending nominally. They'd taken a different profile from the gliders, using a longer, higher aerobrake path, then dropping steeply. They were scheduled to hard land on the ground behind Mimu Bay. Watching their tracking data, Lawrence could see they were already spreading too wide, and that was before a chute deployment left them vulnerable to wind. From experience, he knew nearly half of them would scatter outside the designated area. Rounding them up would take a long time. The coastline was visible ahead, growing rapidly. Just how fast they were losing altitude had become apparent with the way the horizon's curvature was flattening out. When he moved forward in his seat, he could see the archipelago spread out below him. It was as if the dark ocean had been stained with droplets of cream. Hundreds of isles and atolls had been created by the crests of coral mountains that had risen up from the ocean floor over a kilometer down, emerging on the surface to accumulate cloaks of white sand. Waves broke against the reefs in gentle sprays of surf. The larger spreads of coral were hosting tufts of vegetation. Dark meandering mounds were visible in the water between the atolls where the submerged reefs lurked. It reminded him of Queensland's coastline, where ZB's ecological restoration teams had worked their quiet miracles on the ailing Great Barrier Reef. Only the blue tinge of the vegetation was evidence that they were on an alien world. Closer to the mainland, the islands were larger, homes to thick forests. Then the plant leaves were a verdant green, and the beaches protected by long, curving wave walls of broken coral. They all had wooden jetties extending out into the ocean. Huts were visible beneath the palm trees, sailing boats and canoes drawn up on the sand. "Too good to be true," Dennis said. "Maybe we should just stay here when the starships leave." "Nice idea," Nick said, "but the residents would slice you up into fish bait if they found you." The drop glider shook enthusiastically for a few seconds as their speed fell below Mach 1. The nose dropped, and the familiar sight of Mimu Bay was directly ahead, huddled in the folds of unnervingly tall mountains. The speed of their approach made Lawrence's natural skin crawl. Drop gliders had the aerodynamic characteristics of a brick. The only thing that kept them stable was their forward momentum, and they were shedding that rapidly. The harbor drifted off to starboard, leaving them pointing at a shallow bay of gingery sand. A marble-walled promenade ran its entire length, separating beach from buildings. What looked like a line of police cars was parked along the top, with blue strobes flashing enthusiastically. Their AS tipped the nose up again, shedding more speed. They lost altitude at a dramatic rate once they leveled out. The beach was less than a kilometer away now, and the waves were only a couple of hundred meters below. "Stand by," Lawrence called. "Brace yourselves." Miles Hazeldine stood on the balcony that ran around the fourth floor of City Hall, watching the sky over the ocean. His two senior aides hovered behind him. Don and Jennifer had been with him since he was a first-time councilman, 20 years ago now, one of the youngest ever to be elected in Mimu Bay. They'd stayed loyal ever since, throughout all the wearying backbiting and dirt-slinging of Democratic politics. Even the dubious deals with the business community that helped his campaign funding hadn't put them off. All of them had lost their naive idealism, probably back in that first term when he used to make hothead speeches condemning the then-mayor. Now they made a practical, level-headed team who ran the city with a decent level of efficiency, well-equipped to deal with the new generation of young hotheads in the council who constantly criticized him. God damn, he was proud of the way he'd overseen Mimu Bay's development in recent years. This was a prosperous settlement. High economic index, lowish crime rates. Shit. Social problems, unions, bureaucrats, finance, scandals. He could handle any of that. But this kind of crisis was beyond anybody's ability to survive. If he took a heroic stand and resisted Xantiu Braun, he'd aggravate the situation and the invasion force governor would sling him out anyway. He'd achieve nothing. While if he cooperated and worked alongside the governor to ensure the bastards stole everything they wanted, he'd be a collaborator, a traitor to his electorate. They'd never forgive that. A swarm of black dots materialized high in the clean azure sky, moving with incredible speed as they sank toward the beach on the east of town. Miles hung his head in shameful fury. Edgar Strauss himself had called yesterday, urging him to cooperate. None of us want a bloodbath, Miles. Don't let it happen, please. Don't let them take our dignity as well. Another good politician lost to events out of their control. Miles had almost asked, in God's name, why didn't you fund exo-orbit defenses? Why have you left us helpless against this? But that would have been too much like kicking a man when he was down. The best missiles Thallspring could have come up with would have been a pathetic token gesture. God alone knew how advanced Earth's weapons technology was these days. And the ZB starships would have retaliated, made an example. Miles shuddered as he remembered the last invasion. His son, dead. The meager ration of food for months afterward as they struggled to get back on their feet. And everyone had accessed the pictures of the new blasted land on the edge of Durell, that highly unsubtle and very effective demonstration of their capability. He knew what he would have to do, the public example he would have to set. It would ruin him. He might even have to leave Mimu Bay after ZB withdrew. But then he'd known that when he ordered the police to seal off the beach and clamp down on any physical bravado as the drop gliders arrived. Cooperation would mean keeping a lid on any stupid acts of defiance by the population. Lives would be saved. Although he'd never be thanked. Maybe he did owe Mimu Bay's population for all those crabby backroom deals he'd put together down the years. It was a view that helped ease some of the numb depression. A barrage of sonic booms made him jump. They were so like explosions. Glass rattled in just about every window. He could see flocks of birds taking to the air above the city, wings flapping in wild shock. Out in the bay, the first of the drop gliders were splash landing. Dumpy cones streaking down through the air at nearly 45 degrees to smack into the lazy waves a couple of hundred meters offshore. Huge plumes of spray shot out from the impact point, then followed them as they skidded along the top of the water, gradually dying away as they slowed. Several of the craft careened into the sand with a drawn-out crunching sound, twisting around sharply. One almost made it to the promenade wall, its nose finishing only a couple of meters short. Pity, Don grunted. The majority of drop gliders finished up, bobbing in the shallows. Their hatches blew off. Burly dark figures jumped out and began wading ashore, kicking effortlessly through the water. Miles recognized that color, size, and strength all too well. A big banner suddenly unrolled down the promenade wall. Die, screaming Nazi fuckheads! Kids raced away from it. The police officers, leaning over the rail to watch the drop gliders, made no effort to catch them. Oh, very original, Miles muttered under his breath. He could only hope that would be the worst the local hooligans would do. He turned to Don and Jennifer. Let's go. The invaders were already running up the promenade steps and spreading out along the top. They seemed to be ignoring the police. Miles took the elevator down to the mayor's private apartment at the back of City Hall. He didn't really like the place. The ceilings were too high and the rooms too big. It was no place for a family to live. But his own house was away on the other side of town, 40 minutes away, so during the week they had to stay here. His office had wide patio doors that opened onto a small central garden. He saw Francine out there, lying on one of the benches under the shade of a Japanese pine. She was wearing a simple black dress with white piping. The skirt was shorter than he approved of, well above the knee. But he hadn't won that kind of argument with her since she was 13. Cindy would have known how to cope with her, he thought. Damn, I should have married again. Never finding time was such a pathetic excuse. Francine adjusted her sunglasses. Miles could see a frown on her brow and realized she must be accessing the news channels. He wanted to go out to her and put his arms around her and offer her some comfort and promise that it would be over soon and that she wouldn't be harmed. The sort of thing real fathers would be doing all over Thall Spring right now. But the senior staff and the party leadership were waiting for him, and they had family, too. He sat behind the desk with one last reluctant look at the patio door. "I'd just like to say that if anyone else wants to resign, effective immediately, then I will accept it. It won't affect your pensions or benefits." There was a moment of awkward silence, but no one came forward. "Okay, then. Thank you for your support. I do appreciate it. As you know, I've decided to follow Strauss's lead with a policy of cooperation. They're a hell of a lot more powerful than us, and God knows, more evil. Trying to sabotage the chemical plants or throw rocks at their soldiers is just going to lead to retaliation on a scale I cannot accept. So we just grin and bear it and hope their starships all hit a black hole on the voyage back. If we do that, I think we can come through this relatively unscathed, at least as far as infrastructure is concerned. Margaret?" Margaret Reese, the chief of police, gave a reluctant nod. She was looking at the reports scrolling down her membranes rather than at anything in the room. "I studied the files from last time. They really are only interested in pillaging our industrial output. That's where their enforcement comes in. We can do what the hell we like in the rest of town, riot and burn it to the ground. They simply won't care. As long as the factories remain intact, they're supplied with raw material, and the staff turn up for each shift, they'll leave us alone." "And that's what we ensure happens," Miles said. "The rest of our civic business carries on as normal. To keep the factories operational, we keep the town functioning. That's the service we provide, no matter what." "Do they steal our food as well?" Jennifer asked. "I remember there wasn't much to go around last time." "They'll only take what they need to eat themselves," Margaret said. "Given that 30% of the tourists managed to make it out before flights were grounded this morning, the food refineries we've got will give us a large overcapacity for the remaining population. The reason food was short last time is some rebel moron went and firebombed two of the production lines." "Which we can't allow to happen again," Miles said swiftly. "I'm not having some heroic resistance movement putting innocent lives in danger." "I doubt we'll get an organized resistance," Margaret said. "ZB always makes sure the punishment for any action against them outweighs the propaganda gains. But we're keeping a close eye on the people we know can make trouble." "What about the tourists?" Don asked. "There's a lot of them didn't make it home. The airport looks like a refugee camp." "Not my decision," Miles said. He had to squash his anger so he could speak in a clear voice. "The governor will say how much civil transport will be allowed. Given why they're here, I expect they'll want everyone at home being as productive as possible." "One of their platoons has reached the main square," Margaret announced loudly. "They'll be here any minute." "So quickly?" Miles took a breath. So much would depend on what kind of working relationship he could establish with the governor. "Okay, let's go greet the bastards with a smile." Denise milled with the crowd on the edges of the Livingston district. Human curiosity had won out over trepidation, allowing hundreds of people to come watch the spectacle firsthand. Few children had been allowed out, though. This was mainly adults and older teenagers, staring grimly at the streets that led down to the waterfront where the police had established a no-go zone. Conversation was dark mutters of resentment, folklore of what skin suits were capable of, and the atrocities committed last time. Bars were still open and well frequented. Most of the men were clutching cans of beer, drinking steadily as they watched on their glasses and membranes the drop gliders bursting out of the sky. The attitude reminded Denise of pre-match anxiety, home team fans barely tolerating the provocative antics of their rivals. Animal territorialism was still a strong component of the human psyche. That was going to work to her advantage. This was a very volatile situation, and most of the police were covering the waterfront and promenade. The mayor had been worried about his good citizens rampaging down onto the sand as the drop gliders beached. Idiot. An open beach was no place for urban conflict, not against well-organized troops. Her sunglasses were showing data pool video relays of the gliders arriving. The discordant voice of the crowd rose around her. She dispatched a series of coded messages to cell members scattered along the street. Acknowledgments came back. Everyone was ready. The first ZB troopers appeared at the end of the street, five of them, striding along confidently. There wasn't even a pause when they saw the crowd. Denise raised her sunglasses and stared at the first one. Her irises, focus shifted for a detailed close-up. The skin was very similar to what she remembered, as if a bodybuilder were wearing a dark gray leotard. They all had very fat fingers and strange bulges along the arm. Their helmet design had altered. The skin's pliability ended around the jaw, turning into a protective shell covering the upper face and skull. There was a tiara band of sensors at eye level and two gill vents on the cheeks. The only visible weapon was a cumbersome pistol clipped to a belt along with some pouches. Must be for effect, she thought. Heat profile was surprisingly uniform, with only a couple of degrees difference across the whole suit surface. Her view pulled back. There were nine skins walking up the street. A chorus of obscene, taunting chants rose from the crowd, who were moving back and forth restlessly along the pavement. Nobody ventured closer than 4 or 5 meters. Then a young man walked out into the middle of the road directly ahead of the skins. He was carrying a can of beer, which he drained in a couple of big gulps. The skins ignored him as they got closer, so he turned his back to them, bent down, and dropped his shorts. "Kiss my ass!" The crowd laughed and jeered. Several cans clattered onto the road around the skins, spinning around as foaming beer sprayed out of the open tabs. Still, the skins kept going, silent and seemingly unstoppable. Denise had to admit their discipline was good. Her ring pearl was picking up short data bursts from individual suits. Her prime started to break down the heavy encryption. A rock sailed over the heads of the crowd to smack against a skin's chest. Denise's enhanced vision captured the sequence as the outer layer hardened around the impact point. The skin's stride halted momentarily as the rock bounced off him. Still, none of them retaliated. Emboldened by their apparently passive attitude, a couple of tough lads ran out and tried to rugby-tackle the invaders. One skin stopped as the first lad charged toward him, turning so they were facing. The lad was yelling at the top of his voice as he spread his arms wide, ready for the collision. A second before they hit, the skin darted swiftly to one side, bending slightly, one arm coming round. It was a perfectly timed throw. The skin's arm caught the lad in his chest and lifted with tectonic strength. He left the ground, momentum flipping him until he was upside down above the skin. Then the powered push ended. His boozy battle cry had turned to pure terror as he found himself inverted, 3 meters in the air and hurtling toward a shop wall. His arms and legs flailed wildly as the now silent crowd watched. There was a wet thud and the sudden loud crack of snapping bone as he hit the bottom of the wall. His cry cut off dead. The other skin simply extended his arm, fingers flat, and pointing at his assailant. He never moved as the second lad cannoned into him, the extended finger striking the middle of his chest. There was a bright flash of electricity, and the lad jerked backward, limbs thrashing madly from the discharge. He crumpled onto the pavement, twitching. The crowd growled its resentment. They began to close in on the skins. A swarm of beer cans and stones started to fly. Lawrence had known it was a bad situation as soon as they got off the promenade and he saw the crowd lining the street ahead. He would have preferred the police to let the town's population through on the beach. The street pushed everyone together. It could cause serious casualties. "Keep calm," he told the platoon, mainly for Hal's benefit. "They have to find out what we're capable of sometime. Might as well be now. A quick shock demonstration will make them think twice in the future." The shouts and insults were nothing. Beer sprayed around their feet and they splashed through. A very well-aimed rock caught Odell on his chest. "Ignore it," Lawrence ordered. "Shouldn't we tell them to keep back?" Hal asked. There was a hint of unease in his voice. "They're just getting worse." "This is nothing," Edmund said. "One skin could take these pimps out. Stop sweating it, kid." Lawrence expanded Hal's telemetry out of the grid, checking the kid's heart rate, which was high but acceptable. "To these people, we must appear invincible," Amorcy said. "Half of that trick is making them believe it. So just swagger along nice and easy. Come on, remember your training." Two fury-driven young men charged out of the crowd, heading straight for the platoon. "No weapons," Lawrence commanded. "Lewis, shock yours." The other was heading straight for Hal. Lawrence said nothing, waiting to see how the kid would handle it. As it turned out, the throw was perfect, sending the youth crashing against the bottom of a wall. "Way to go, kid," Nick whooped. "Nice one," Jones said admiringly. "You could have turned faster, though." "You couldn't," Hal said cheerfully. "Too old. Your reflexes are shot." "Shit on you." "Pull in formation," Lawrence said. He didn't like the mood of the crowd. "Hal, well done. Everyone, let's not get excited here." The crowd was moving in, winding themselves up for a head-on clash. Cans and stones were coming at them from all directions. "You going to dart them?" Dennis asked. "Not yet." Lawrence switched on his external speaker and cranked the volume up. "Stand back." He could see the people closest to him wince, putting their hands over their ears. "You are causing a civil disturbance, and I have the authority to disperse you with appropriate force. Now calm down and go home. The governor and mayor will address you shortly." His amplified voice was lost under a howl of obscenities. Looking out at the raw hatred facing him, he imagined what it would be like standing here without skin. The lapse made him shiver. "All right, grab your punch pistols. I want..." His suit's AS flashed a warning at the center of the tactical display grid. Sensors had picked up a thermal point approaching fast. The Molotov arched through the sky, trailing a streamer of bright blue flame from the high hydrogen fuel. It was spinning as it went, curving down toward Carl. "Let it hit," Lawrence ordered. Carl's arm was already extended, the 9mm muzzle poking through the carapace. Targeting lasers had found the Molotov. "Oh, man," Carl grunted. "I hate this, Sarge." The Molotov crashed down on his helmet. The glass burst, flinging out a sheet of dense flame that enveloped the whole suit. People nearby yelped, scrambling back out of the way as the flames grew hotter, gorging on the fuel. The rest of the platoon calmly took their punch pistols up and flicked the safeties off. "Give them the talk, Carl," Lawrence said. The flames died away, revealing the skin suit standing unharmed. "The person who threw that is under arrest," Carl said through his speakers. "Step forward, please, now." He took his own punch pistol from his belt. "I said, now." The crowd began shouting and chanting again. More stones were flung. Then another 3 Molotovs appeared in the air. Again, they were all aimed at Carl. "Someone's organized," Lawrence realized suddenly. The Molotovs were aimed at the same place and came from different directions at the same time. "Take them out," he ordered. Carl and Amorcy shot the bottles in mid-flight. Giant fireballs ruptured the air and poured down. Flame splashed over a dozen people who ran screeching in agony. The crowd went berserk and charged forward en masse. "Disperse!" Lawrence yelled at them above the bedlam. He aimed his punch pistol and fired. The plastic bullet caught a man in the middle of his chest, slamming him back into the three behind him. They tumbled like human bowling pins. Rushing feet trampled them. The platoon had formed up in a circle. The punch pistols began firing. Psychologically, they should have acted as a much greater deterrent than darts. A mean-looking weapon, a loud gunshot, and a man goes flying. It was obvious and physical. You could see it happening. You should run away lest it happen to you. Lawrence's AS alerted him to the sound of gunshots, simultaneously running an analysis program. Someone in the crowd was firing a pump-action shotgun. He saw Dennis stagger backward, his skin carapace totally solid. Where the hell did that come from? Three skin AS programs coordinated their audio triangulation and indicated the line of fire. Lawrence's visual sensor showed him a man running through the crowd. Something long, dark, in his hand. He gave the image to Lewis and Nick. Snatch, I want him. They charged forward into the mob, ruthlessly thrusting people aside. Someone jumped on Odell's back, an arm around his neck, trying to strangle him. He reached around and picked off the attacker effortlessly. Two men lunged at Lawrence. He hit one, going for the arm, kicked at the other, hearing the leg splinter. Each time, the skin's AS moderated the strength of the blow. A full strike from a skin fist could smash clean through a human rib cage. Unless you wanted to kill somebody, always go for the limbs. They were too close now for the punch pistol. He dodged one madman who was swinging a chair at his head. Another broke a bottle across his shoulder. Ragged glass spikes slithered uselessly over the skin carapace. Jones screamed. Lawrence saw his grid turn red. Graphics swirled madly as the AS tried to make sense of the data. Visual sensors locked on. Jones was falling, arms waving slowly. He hit the pavement and his fists cracked the stone slabs. Jones, Lawrence yelled. Status? Okay, Jones gurgled. Electric shock. I'm okay. Motherfuck. They zapped me with a charge. God damn, it was a brute. Amorcy, Lawrence ordered. Dart them. Amorcy held his arm up high. Nozzles slid out through the carapace around his wrist. 50 darts popped out. It was as if God had reached down and switched people off. The front ranks of the mob crumpled with startled expressions that swiftly faded to the neutral face of the deep sleeper. Within seconds, a 15-meter logjam of inert bodies surrounded Lawrence and the platoon. Beyond that, the remainder of the crowd stared down at their comatose compatriots in numb horror. Amorcy fired another salvo. Screams broke out as more people fell. The remainder began running, vanishing down side streets at an incredible rate. One for the good guys, Edmund said. They're crazy, Hal whined. Totally fucking crazy. Is it going to be like this the whole time? One sincerely hopes not, Odell said. Jones? Lawrence walked over to the trooper, who was now sitting up. You okay? Shit, I guess so. The insulation blocked most of it. Bloody thing scrambled half of my electronics. Systems are coming back online. E-Alpha Fortress is rebooting the full AS. Lawrence didn't like the sound of that at all. The suit should have shielded him from just about any kind of current, and the electronics were EMP hardened. He looked round the deserted street. A lot of the unconscious bodies were bleeding, and he could see several who'd been caught by the Molotovs. The burns looked bad. Rocks, Molotovs, shotguns, electric shock. We were being tested, he thought. Someone wanted to know our skin capability. Dennis, check Jones over, please. Yes, Sarge. Did anyone see who hit Jones with the shock? I was busy, Carl said. Sorry. That's okay. We can run the sensor memories. Newton, Captain Bryant said. What the hell's happened? Crowd got out of control, sir. I don't think... The display grid with Nick Fuccio's video and telemetry flickered and turned black. A medical alarm began to shrill in Lawrence's ears. Sarge, Lewis cried. Sarge, they shot him. Oh, Jesus. Oh, fuck. They shot him. Dennis, Lawrence yelled. With me. He was sprinting, moving at incredible speed over the sprawled bodies, then powering down a narrow side street. Bright indigo navigation display scrolled down, guiding his feet. Left turn, right turn, curve, right turn. Clump of people across the narrow road. standing, staring. He slammed them aside, ignoring the pained protests. A skin was lying spread eagle on the cobbled road. Dark red blood was spreading out from it in a thick, glistening puddle. A fist-sized hole had ripped into the carapace between Nick's shoulders. It was bad, but his skin could have sustained him. The suit's circulatory system was still plugged into the jugular and carotid splices. In such extreme damage situations, the AS would keep the brain supplied with blood until the field medics arrived. Whoever the sniper was, he must have known that. The second shot had been fired when Nick was down. It had taken off the top half of his head, leaving nothing from the nose upward. Lewis was kneeling on the road beside him. Emergency disposal valves had opened on his lower helmet, allowing a stream of vomit to splash down his chest.
"He's dead," Lewis wailed. "Dead. Never had a chance."
Lawrence glanced around. The civilians were backing off fast. Heads vanished into windows, which were slammed shut. "Where did it come from?" Lawrence asked.
"Oh, God. Oh, God."
Lewis was rocking back and forth.
"Lewis, where did the shots come from?"
"I don't fucking know."
Lawrence looked up and down the nearly empty street, reviewing the last of Nick's telemetry. He was running eastward, so judging from the impact, he had been shot from behind. There was no obvious window or balcony for the shooter. When Lawrence raised his view, he saw a church tower standing above the roofs. The whole street was exposed to it, but it must have been over a kilometer away. Miles Hazeldine's single quiet hope that the governor would be a shrewd political operator, open to compromise, vanished into the air before they even met. He stood outside the main doors of City Hall, watching the skin-suited invaders march across the main square. The few locals who stubbornly stood their ground were shoved violently out of the way. ZB's goons never bothered to modify their suit's strength, so the victims really did tumble backward to land awkwardly on the hard slabs. The three leading the column trotted up the broad stone steps to the doors. At the last minute, Miles realized they weren't going to stop. He hurriedly stepped aside as they barged in, nearly breaking the heavy glass and wood doors. It wasn't their strength that made Miles's heart sink, but the deliberate arrogance.
"Hey," he began. "You are the mayor?"
It was an unnecessarily loud voice booming from one of the skins that had stopped in front of Miles and his people. "I am the democratically elected leader of Memu Bay Council, yes."
"Come with us."
"Very well. I'd like to..."
"Now."
Miles shrugged to his aides and went back into City Hall. The ZB goons were spreading out through the large entrance hall. Their tough heels made a clattering noise like hooves on the marble tile flooring. Nervous staff peering through open doorways moved aside briskly as the big, impassive suits started to check out all the offices. Several of them were jogging up the twin looped stairs to the first floor. The main group made their way directly to the mayor's apartment. Miles had to take fast steps to keep up with him. Nobody asked him directions. The layout would be in their suit memories, of course. "I should have changed the architecture around inside," he thought. That would have pissed them off and spoiled the know-it-all effect. The doors to his inner study were flung open. Seven of the skins walked in. Miles saw Francine jump up from the bench out in the garden. She grabbed hold of Melanie and lifted the little girl up so she was cradling her. Melanie's face was sulky with resentment, but not fearful, Miles saw proudly. He made a brief calming gesture at his daughters. One of the ZB goons stood by the door and pointed at Miles's aides.
"You,"
the voice reverberated, "wait out here." A chubby finger beckoned Miles.
"You, inside."
Miles found himself standing in front of his own desk as the doors were slammed shut behind him. One of the suited figures sat down in his own chair. Miles winced as the antique pine creaked under the immense weight. "You should learn to control your suits more carefully," he said calmly. "There won't be a door left in Memu Bay by the time you leave." There was silence for a moment. Then the figure's suit split open down the chest. That was where the impressive routine of invincibility fell apart slightly. He had to struggle to pull his head out of the helmet, and when he did, his face was covered in a sticky blue goo. Miles grinned.
Did you sneeze in there?
I am Ebrey Zhang, commander of ZB forces in Memu Bay and the surrounding settlement regions, which makes me governor of the civil population. I'm now going to give you the only piece of advice you'll get for the whole occupation. Don't play the smartass with me, understand? He was about what Miles had expected, somewhere in his 40s, with dark Asian skin and slightly narrowed eyes, black hair that was receding. His eyeballs were covered in an unusually thick optomic membrane, similar to lizard scales. It didn't make his scowl any more effective, just a standard-issue military bureaucrat trying to appear uncompromising and totally in control.
Straight talk, huh? Miles asked.
Yes, I don't like politicians. You twist words too much.
I don't like occupying armies. You kill people.
Good. Then we have a deal. You're the mayor, Miles Hazeldine, yes?
Yes.
I want the access codes for your civil administration network.
They didn't need them, of course. With their software, they could probably establish total control over the network in seconds. That wasn't the point. This was the defeated barbarian chief kneeling before Caesar, acknowledging Rome's authority and glory.
Certainly, Miles said. He told his desktop Pearl to display the codes.
Ebrey turned to one of the faceless suits. I want us interfaced and supervising the local data pool in 90 minutes. Get me a full industrial capacity review and a police file interrogation. I want to know what they've got and who's likely to resist.
Sir, the suited figure replied.